on this episode of Skeptico.
So I think when your confidence in materialism wanes a little bit, I think that's an opening for what you're talking about.
No, you may be right. But again, let me put it this way. There's a certain sort of psychology involved here that can erect defenses against that. Yeah, if you can amass, if you can accumulate sufficient evidence, you know, that should call into question these easy materialist assumptions, yeah, sure, that has a clarifying effect. Still, again, my interests are in the whole, how can I put it, set of logical assumptions underlying naturalism that don't accord with any experience at all, not just extraordinary experiences.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on this episode, an episode I've been looking forward to bringing to you for a while. It's one that I really had to prepare for a lot. You suggested Dr. David Bentley Hart, and I'm really glad you did. But if you dig into his work, one of the things you realize is that this is a very smart guy. Someone you want to be on your toes for when you're talking to them. And if you doubt me, then go check out some of the debates/dialogues he's had with various atheist, secular, materialist types out there. They are cringeworthy, if you know what I mean. So I prepared quite a bit for this interview, and the other reason I did is because Dr. Hart and I share a similar religious background. He's Eastern Orthodox, and I grew up in a Greek Orthodox church in Wilmont, Illinois, outside of Chicago, where my brother and I would squirm around in the unbelievably uncomfortable wooden pews that they had until my very Greek, very religious grandmother would be so frustrated that she would reach over with just the tip of a straight pin and stick it in our leg. And although that sounds really cruel, it worked. We didn't squirm a lot after that. So that was my religious background as a kid, and even though I'm not a Christian anymore, one thing that's lingered from that whole experience is the question of what was really going on. I mean, why were these smart, otherwise intelligent people, and I know they are because I knew them outside of church, why were they sitting there watching these grown men walk around with these huge icons and gold-encrusted robes while they're swinging all this incense? I mean, why are they sitting through all this nonsense? And while I may not have gotten a direct answer to that question during this dialogue with Dr. David Bentley Hart, I did get a pretty satisfying one, because Dr. Hart is the embodiment of the intellectual, spiritual, religious seeker. Now, you're not going to hear him engaged in silly apologetics about empty tombs and baby Jesus and all the rest of that nonsense. But what you will hear is someone who's thought deeply about the big, big questions. Who are we? Why are we here? And how do we relate to that ever-present little voice inside of our head? These are the questions I care about. These are the questions I sought to answer with Skeptico from the very beginning. And these are the questions I think Dr. Hart is after as well. So I really enjoyed this dialogue. We talked about a number of topics, including the wacky metaphysics of no metaphysics that is atheism and has embedded itself in the secular/atheistic science that we encounter. But we also look behind that and talk about what might really be going on with atheism and with Christianity. And then finally, near the end, we get to some really good stuff. Consciousness, bliss, and what all this stuff might really be about. It's a dialogue I really enjoyed having, and one that I hope you like too. Here's Dr. David Bentley Hart. Today we welcome theologian, philosopher, author, and I gotta add the label intellectual in there because Dr. David Bentley Hart certainly does remind us of what it means to be a true intellectual. Dr. Hart is the author of several books, including Atheist Delusions, a book that was awarded the Michael Ramsey Prize in Theology,
and his latest, The Experience of God, Being, Consciousness, Bliss. David, welcome to Skeptico. Thanks so much for joining me.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
First off, I have to tell you, I have had a great time digging into your work, and I have to thank, first off, a couple of Skeptico listeners, in particular Mark, who reached out and set up this interview. It's been great for me. I'm still, I think, trying to get my arms around everything you do, so forgive me. Your writing is extraordinary. It's a little dense. I found myself jumping over to the dictionary more than a time or two, but that's fun. That's great, and anyone will find
well,
that.
Well, you know, Goethe said, it's a poor writer with whom a lexicon can keep pace. So.
Love it. Well, you know, as an introduction to where you're coming from for my audience, for the Skeptico audience, one of the things that comes through loud and clear is this most complete and eloquent dismantling of this crazy scientific materialism we talk so much about. You write, and let me read this for folks. Naturalism, that is this idea also called materialism, that we're all biological robots in a meaningless universe, basically what naturalism means, is a picture of the whole of reality that cannot, according to its own intrinsic premises, address the being of the whole. And I love this next one. It's a metaphysics of the rejection of metaphysics, a transcendental certainty of the impossibility of transcendental truth, and so requires an act of so pure credence, logically immune from any verification. Brilliant stuff. Can you elaborate just a little bit on that?
I suppose I could, yeah. Well, I mean, naturalism is in a sense, its own worst enemy, because it's, especially in the Anglophone world, generally advanced as a coherent philosophy of the causal closure of the physical, of the impossibility of thought reaching beyond the boundaries of natural causation, as we understand that term. In the modern world, we tend to think of nature as a result of ideas that go back to the 17th century as meaning unguided mechanistic processes that yield as the residue of interactions and attritions and so forth, an ordered whole. The problem is with naturalism is that it rules out of court all the vantages that it requires in order to certify itself. That is, it tells us what we can't know, but can only do so from a position beyond the totality of nature, which is precisely the position it claims we can never occupy. So I think that's what that – you'd have to remind me of the whole context of that sentence, incidentally, because when you write a lot, you tend to forget what you've written where and when.
I think you've captured it quite well, both in that sentence or two and in your explanation of it. I love the metaphysics of the rejection of metaphysics, because I think in typical kind of new atheist fashion, when you mention that they're – a logical argument rests on metaphysics, they often have this kind of curious look on their face, like, no, we're not into metaphysics, you're into metaphysics. It's like, well, no, that's a metaphysical claim that you're making. So I think you do a wonderful job of that.
Well, it's inevitably so, isn't it? And it's not just their logic, and that's a rather generous term to use quite often. But just that the picture of reality itself is a metaphysical dogma, not a metaphysical system even.
Right. It's an assertion that.
Yeah. You know.
So I tell you what I'd like to do. I actually have five questions for you, and they're a little bit.
Okay, but don't ask anything about my experiences in Malaysia. I like to keep that veiled in obscurity.
Okay, I have six questions for you. So we're going to kind of bounce around. I'll try and frame each one, and then maybe we'll publish each one of them separately. I don't know. But the first has to do with atheist reactionaryism, if you will. I'm not sure that's a word. But you know, you provide this searing attack of atheists that anyone who tunes into any of your videos on YouTube, it's just delightful stuff to listen to. It's so fun to listen to, and it's also packed with a lot of good points. Let me play folks here a clip.
They put it very simply, and I think with absolute objectivity, their books are excruciatingly lousy. And when I first read them, I have to admit that I was just astonished that any excitement could be generated by books that were so incoherent and that had such an evidence of historical ignorance, philosophical clumsiness, sanctimony, viciousness. I mean, viciousness is a running constant through all of them. But ultimately, inanity. These were vapid books. They were frothy books. They're books that are that don't rise above the level of light entertainment for people who get a thrill from being insulting.
And that was from an interview you gave after publishing your book, Atheist Delusions.
By the way, that's not my title. I always have to stick that in. My title was the subtitle. But go on.
That you have to live with it, don't you?
Yeah,
so here, I guess, is my question. It's hard for me to argue with the main thrust of what you're saying. And I've done probably 24 shows on atheism and interviewed so many of the prominent members of the atheist community that I get where you're coming from. But I also feel like my position vis-a-vis the atheist has softened a little bit. I mean, first off, isn't this new atheism nonsense really a reactionary position? So, you know, they might not have your intellectual muscle, David, and they might be somewhat of nitwits about philosophy, like you point out, but they're reacting to the day-to-day idiocy we get from some of the American evangelical community. I mean, just stroll through the bestseller list of Christian books on Amazon. You know, the apocalyptic Left Behind books and the simple-minded apologetics of, what's that book, A Case for Christ. I mean, these are not exactly...
I've never even heard of that one, but I can probably guess what it's like.
Like, these are not towering tombs.
In fairness, I think if you've read, and you've written, I think you can say fairly, I'm just as hard on those people, even if they're not the object of what I'm writing about. So
what about the atheists as a reaction to that? Can't we kind of understand where they're coming from?
Well, it depends. I mean, it depends on whom you're talking about. And don't leave out the other thing they're reacting against is the rise in violence perpetrated in the name of Islam, and quite often an attack on religion in general is a sort of proxy assault on specifically Islam as well. So there are all sorts of reactions and reactionary currents in it, but you have to treat it author by author. In the case of Richard Dawkins, I think you'd be overly generous there. It's true that that he's frustrated by six-day creationists, but then again, he goes out of his way to seek them out and refuses to engage in argument with persons of more sophisticated philosophical or theological or historical training. And at that point, he looks, given that, there's something opportunistic in his reactions. You know, he could, if he wanted, and he brags about this at times, you know, he's going to the belly of the beast, when in fact he's dealing with a very specific socioeconomic, cultural reality situated largely in the United States, if not exclusively. And he is clever enough to know that he's not really astute enough philosophically or good enough on his feet that he could enter into debate publicly with serious interlocutors and come out looking good. And the few times he has done that, he has, you know, he's not like Jerry Coyne, sort of his American derivative.
lesser derivative, but okay.
Yeah, no, well, with the problem with Coyne is he doesn't really, he actually doesn't know what he doesn't know. And so he does wade in and he does make a fool of himself.
Right.
And the good thing about that is you just step back and let him go. But Dawkins, I don't know if Dawkins is a reactionary in the same way. Christopher Hitchens, alas, departed, was a real moralist. I mean, this is true. And though he didn't have any great speculative gifts. I mean, basically, he was a journalist. And when he touched on philosophical or speculative issues, it was clear that he was very much out of his depth, and he was sort of rushed by them as quickly as possible. But of them all, he was the most respectable because there was a sort of intense moral seriousness there that sometimes got veiled behind the character he created for himself in public. And in fact, there was supposed to be a debate between him and me. I think it was going to be at Columbia. I don't remember the details. That was being set up just at the time he fell very ill and his cancer was diagnosed. And I would have enjoyed that debate. For one thing, it would have given me a chance to see if the Jack Daniels in the coffee cup is true or urban legend. But the other thing is that even if there were things he was reacting against of a different, not necessarily the ones you're thinking of. He actually, but there was a moral seriousness there. It depends on which new atheist you're talking about. Daniel Dennett has for a long time been engaged in a philosophical project of his own that I think is fundamentally incoherent.
Right.
But what is he reacting against? I don't know. His passions seem to be rooted much more deeply than a sort of frustration.
I think they are rooted deeply, and I think that kind of leads into my second question is, isn't what really is at play for a lot of these folks is a deep wounding that's been done by Christianity that's never kind of brought to the surface. So again, we can call the logic incoherent and their crappy metaphysics. But if you have a family member who's been sexually abused by a Catholic priest, you don't know how necessarily to express that. Or if you're gay or lesbian and you're told, God hates fags or whatever however you're told that message, you have a deep pain there. And then these guys come along and they say, wow, here's someone articulating what I feel but can't express. And they sound so smart. I mean, isn't that the lure a lot of times for...
And look, I mean, I'm willing to give, I mean, if we're just talking in general about people who reject faith or reject Christianity, I'm willing to give them more credit even than that. It may not just be personal personal grievances. We live in a reality in which children die of incurable diseases. Chance disaster destroys innocent people and innocent lives. Pain is ubiquitous. Death is inevitable. So there are serious moral, spiritual, existential reasons to rebel against the frame of reality. I have no problem with that. And if it's conducted in that register, with that intonation, serious atheism is one of the great accomplishments of 19th and 20th century, especially serious thought. And I admire it. I revere it. The new atheists, though, I'm not willing to put in the company of a Camus or a Nietzsche or a seriously reflective atheist, because what they have produced does not merit comparison with the works of those thinkers. And so I would want to make a distinction there. But I have nothing against atheism as such. It is specifically this sort of willfully historically ignorant, inadvertently philosophically incompetent and rhetorically vicious atheism that has seized popular attention, although it seems to be a bit on the wane now in influence, to be honest. I mean, 2006 was the annus mirabilis of the movement, and it enjoyed a certain buoyancy in the aftermath of 9/11 and so on. But of late, if, for instance, in England, whenever I'm back in England, I can't help but notice now Richard Dawkins has ceased to be universally revered in public media. I mean, now the BBC and the newspapers tend to treat him with somewhat more aloofness and sometimes ridicule. And in part, that's because his public personality, the more it emerges, the less tolerant it seems. And then, of course, apparently he discovered Twitter recently. That was a mistake. I don't follow social media very closely. So anyway, I'm sorry, that was long-winded. But I do want to make a distinction. A serious, moral, and intellectually coherent rejection of the tenets of faith, of the possibility of a good God, all that, I have no issue with that whatsoever. But I don't think in our present cultural moment that those are the people who are making the biggest splash.
Well, I would agree with you, and that kind of leads into my third question. That is, this new atheist kind of flag-waving thing maybe has waned, but hasn't it really reemerged or been recast as this, what I think, is a phony culture war debate between science and religion that we keep being told is kind of central to our culture and what's going on? And to me, it's so, and I think you point this out in a number of ways, it's so phony, because what's being passed off as science is, again, this awkward metaphysics that you're talking about that comes to the conclusion that life is meaningless, and a proposition that any kind of man on the street, if you will, would just laugh in someone's face. You know, I'm a biological robot. My life is meaningless. The love I share with my family, and you know, that doesn't mean anything. Ridiculous. No one buys into that.
Well, you can convince people to buy into a great deal, though. I mean, there I will disagree with you in the sense that people can't live that way. But doubleness of consciousness is always possible. It's amazing to me, since the publication of The Selfish Gene, for instance, and I mean, I'll answer your bigger question in a moment if I remember it after I go on and on and on. But The Selfish Gene was a bad book as a work of science.
Right.
Quite apart from its social provocations, no one. I mean, even at the time it appeared, it was sort of a dead issue. I mean, no serious molecular biologist thinks of the gene in terms of a master code that inexorably unfolds into three-dimensional structures and has therefore the complete code of life, and at the same time, in some mysterious sense, the dynamism of expression in biological, you know, complex organic systems. I mean, if you look at the state of molecular biology now, a whole variety of causalities are considered, all the different ways in which gene expression is controlled. The actual paucity, to be honest, of coding where you expect it in the genomic sequence has been one of the surprises of the human genome sequence. But the funny thing is that was already pretty well known at the time that book appeared.
Absolutely, but that's the real schizophrenia that we live in. That's the emperor has no clothes. So right. So you can read Dawkins if you're a molecular biologist, but you have to hold your mouth and chuckle. I mean, you can't do it out loud.
Don't miss the crucial point, which is that the metaphor of genetic selfishness and the persistence of this, if you think about this quasi-Nazi, this absolutely silly and logically incoherent notion that the real reason why we do things is actually this thing, this genetic selfishness, which is already an inept metaphor. How pervasive that's become. You'll just see it on television here, on the radio, read it in the press, to the point where people repeat it as just a given. And so it's not a scientific view. It's true.
But see, David, that's my point. I think that is a constructed phony debate because, you know, that fits so well into our, I hate the term secular culture, but in terms of our consumeristic, materialistic, soul-eliminated culture, we like to put that, and then we like to put that up against, oh, because if you don't buy into that, then you're going to buy into this wacky religion over here that is going to make you have this blind obedience to this dogma and all the rest of it. I think it's a constructed debate because it's the debate that allows our culture to move forward in the way that, you know, promotes this consumeristic society that we have.
again, if you've read enough of my stuff, obviously, you know I agree with that. I think, though, the funny thing is that this notion of the great war between science and religion or reason and faith is something, in a sense, it's born in the 18th century, but really it's at the end of the 19th century, and people like Andrew Dixon White writing fake histories of the history of the story of the West that created it's so funny. I mean, can you imagine telling Erwin Schrödinger or Niels Bohr that their commitment to the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum physics or to quantum indeterminacy somehow was at odds with their rather deep religious intuitions and beliefs and convictions, right, which right. they saw as being rationally inevitable in some sense from the things they discovered. No, I mean, obviously, it's a fake dichotomy. You find it more in biology than anywhere else, curiously enough. In the realm of physics, even though the people who run, you know, academic associations of physics may be quite often unthinking materialists, as a rule, among physicists and mathematicians and people outside biology, the percentage of those who consider themselves strict materialists isn't conspicuously larger than in the educated class at large in America, say. You know, it's not really... But in biology, there's an ideological war still being fought, and neo-Darwinianism being the model of biology that is triumphant at the moment in a way that, you know, decades ago displaced other understandings more other ways of approaching biology, the sort of the classical Victorian semi-Aristotelian approach to complex organisms has been displaced by a specific kind of neo-Darwinian geneticentric biology. And there is a working metaphysics that's not just tacit, but that is part of the whole project. I mean, it is the mechanization of nature. And that's where you really find this mythology promoted with the most vigor.
Let's talk about something more important. Let's talk about transcendence. One of the things I really like about your book, The Experience of God, Being, Consciousness, Bliss, is that, as with all your writing, it's poetic and at the same time it's intellectually rigorous. And I think that in and of itself embodies this coming together of the head and the heart that I think is central to what you're trying to bring to us in terms of how we can understand spiritually transformative experiences and this awakening that I think I observe seems to be happening to a larger and larger number of people. You know, one of the shows out there that I really like, and this guy's been on my show several times, is a show called Buddha at the Gas Pump.
I like the title.
So each week, Rick Archer interviews folks who seem to be going through these profound spiritual awakenings, this transcendence. And sometimes it's, you know, the very prominently guy's been on several times, a Christian monk living in a monastery for 15 years. He's praying and boom, he has what the Hindus would call a Kundalini experience. But sometimes it's ordinary people who've had a near death.
Probably more like a Turiya experience, but I'm just guessing. Anyway, go on.
As I've heard, and as is reflected in the very title of this book, Being, Consciousness, Bliss. But you can maybe explain.
Anyway, I tossed in the pedantry there for no good reason, so just go.
The point is, or the question is, you know, what's going on here? What is happening with this deep, transformative experience of God, to borrow the title from your book? Is there something at play? Is there something in the air that's causing more people to achieve this state that we, you know, when I was a kid, I mean, this was the kind of thing you thought a few saints and mystics maybe achieved, you know, a couple times on the planet. But now it seems to be happening more regularly. Do you see that? Do you believe that? Or are you inclined to think that maybe that's kind of internet hype? I don't know.
Yeah, I'm unaware of it, if it's true, to be honest. But it wouldn't surprise me one way or the other. But my real my claim, my answer to that would be that it's always been more common than we imagined. And I don't, as a rule, even though my interest in mysticism of all the great traditions goes very deep, when I write about consciousness, I write about the experience of the transcendent right within the midst of the ordinary, that every ordinary act of consciousness is already saturated with a sort of primordial knowledge of transcendence. So if there is, I don't know, I mean, it's something that I think it would be talked about more, the more oppressively mechanistic the tacit orthodoxy becomes, the more striking and in some sense urgent the expressions of experiences that don't fit into that picture are likely to be. Whether it's actually happening more frequently at this moment than in at other times, I don't know. I mean, I don't know how to quantify it. And you're raising a question that's new to me. I'm not aware of that, but it wouldn't surprise me. Mostly because I think that what we tend to think of as an unusual mystical experience is in many ways the intensification of something that's already present to us in our ordinary experience when we attend to it.
Right.
And all the great spiritual traditions. I mean, you mentioned, I don't know what Buddha at the gas pump means really, but I mean, you know, there is, you know, how many of these traditions, were there, you know, the Christian writings of Evagrius Ponticus and Maximus the Confessor, or Yogacara, Chittamatra texts in Buddhism, or Advaita or Vishishtadvaita Vedanta texts. The attention to ordinary states of consciousness that discovers already the degree to which that at the very ground of human awareness is what is irreducibly transcendent of finite causes.
Right. The Buddha didn't go through an awakening. The Buddha realized he was already in that state, right? Isn't that the essence of the Buddhist teaching? Is that?
Well, it depends on which school you're talking.
Right.
For, you know, I mean, there's some very radical statements like that in, say, Hangaku Shiso Buddhism in Japan. Others, it depends. I mean, let me just say, Buddhism is as every bit as various in its expressions as Christianity or any other long tradition with a large speculative history. But yes, I mean, it's not an awakening in the sense, it's not as if he was transformed into something else. It's that he touched the ground of the reality that was always there. You know, my conviction and the way I approach these things, because of course I'm also working within a phenomenological tradition in philosophy, is that if you examine the act of consciousness in which you are engaged when you're, you know, choosing a tie, you already find dynamisms that exceed the possibilities of the naturalist picture of reality.
Okay, last question, and has to do with the future of Christianity. In your book, Atheist Delusions, which again, you didn't pick that part of the title, you picked the subtitle, but I think you got to live with it.
That's all right. Hey, I think it sold some books.
Yeah, they know what they're doing in that regard, don't they? And also in this latest book, Experience of God, you know, you do really a masterful job of reclaiming Christian history from the sloppy rewriting it's gotten from atheistic academia over the years. But here's the hard question. What are we really trying to preserve and protect? I mean, you're an inspiring guy. I can grab a couple of your books, maybe a couple others, get a group of friends together, and I'm good, right? I mean, unless there's a funeral or a wedding going on down at the church, what do I need to go down there for? I mean, the counter hypothesis, I think, to Christianity is one that I think you're talking all about, and that's that gnosis shows up. You know, if I'm there, if I'm open, gnosis shows up. Why do I need this institution for?
Well, of course, that question is going to have different inflections according to which institution and which experience you have of it. I take it, were raised Greek Orthodox, right?
Yes, I was.
Yes. Well, I am Eastern Orthodox myself. So I wasn't raised though. I was raised High Anglican. If gnosis is what you're after, it's true that you're not constrained to finding it only, and in fact, if you're subjected to a certain kind of sermon, which is all too common, you're likely to find it an impediment. The spiritual life is a spiritual life of community, for one thing. Within Christian thought specifically, it is to become part of a body of love and knowledge. If, you know, in here, this is an old question, after all, in every tradition. You don't have to just address Christianity. One of the great differences between the Mahayana tradition in Buddhism and traditions, I should say, and what they call Hinayana, lesser vehicle, well, let's just call it Abhidharma Buddhism, say, is this great assault on the ethos of the Pratyeka Buddha, who strives only for his own enlightenment and is not moved by the greater compassion, the Mahakaruna, that's described by, say, someone like Shantideva. And when you dwell in that compassion, the compassion of the Bodhisattva who foregoes his own entrance into Nibbana in order to strive for the salvation of all, you find that that compassion, that love itself, is the enlightenment to which every other enlightenment is only a foreshadowing. And, mm-hmm. and so the Bodhisattva discovers that, you know, Samsara and Nibbana are one. Well, in Christian thought, you know, especially this is, you know, the body of love of the God who pours himself out into nothingness, you know, the great Philippians hymn, in order to unite creatures to himself, is a experience that is as much charity as gnosis. You talked about uniting head and heart. Well, the heart doesn't really do well in its, you know, in its own living room by itself. But what do you need it for? Well, I mean, again, if we get into doctrinal issues, it becomes a boring conversation. But do I believe that gnosis is enough? If gnosis doesn't mean life in continuity with a community devoted to the same transcendent horizon of love and knowledge. No, I'd say that's not. I mean, that's not a real awakening yet. That's, you know, that's a kind of enlightenment, but it's not yet a transformation of the self.
Right, but as you alluded to, I mean, I think that gnosis leads to, no matter what the on-ramp we take, we're going to be on that highway of love and compassion, because there's only one, you know, there's only one highway to get.
Occasionally I have discovered you know, sometimes, for instance, I've talked to people who consider themselves perennialists, and specifically within what they understand to be the Advaita Vedanta tradition as translated through Shuan and all, who seem to miss this out. I mean, they give mouth service to people like Ramakrishna, who believe deeply in charity and love towards all, but who talk sometimes in a depressingly almost egoistical way, even though they think they've transcended ego. So about, you know, those who are not enlightened, you know, just very dismissive, and their own, speak of their own enlightenment as something so interior that it doesn't have a communal dimension. It can happen. That can happen in any tradition. I'm just picking them out because that's just one school of thought that puts such an emphasis on gnosis that it often forgets that gnosis is also agape or charity.
David, what are you working on now, and how can folks stay in contact with your work on an ongoing basis?
Well, the project I'm involved in at the moment, I call it a project because it's endowed for this year at Notre Dame. The book I'm writing is a deeper exploration of consciousness that, in a more deliberate and maybe in a more ambitious way, deals with the themes that are raised in the course of the argument in the fourth chapter of my last book. And it starts with, again, a philosophical examination of naturalism and naturalist models of consciousness, but it moves inexorably towards a series of metaphysical and religious claims. So it's a large project. It's on the soul, let's put it that way, on consciousness and the soul.
Great. Now, do you try and incorporate any science in there, consciousness science that's leading us towards a deeper realization of this extended consciousness? We spend a lot of time on the show looking at the science of near-death experience, the science of extended consciousness all over the place, because I think it both completely falsifies this materialism that we're talking about. And I think it's that gets us to the entry point or the gateway of trying to, or being able to really consider seriously some of that stuff. So do you delve into the science of it or not so much or not so much?
Depends on what you mean by the science.
I
mean,
science of, for example, near-death experience, I think, directly.
No, in fact, it may disappoint you, but I go out of my way to avoid that because, once again, of course, it was never an issue with me since I don't believe in the mechanistic picture of the soul. So near-death experiences just seem, not surprising to me, although the accounts you read of them can be disappointing at times.
Right, but, right.
And I've had encounters with Bruce Grace, and I was at UVA, I did my doctorate, and I taught there for a while, and I corresponded with him briefly. But that's actually, what fascinates me are not the way in which extraordinary experiences, which may be contentious and contended, you're not going to be able to hammer that home with great success to a convinced materialist, no matter how much evidence you think you amass there. He's going to deny it. He's going to dismiss a great deal of it as anecdotal or due to a the limits of our ability now to measure deep electrical processes in the cerebral cortex. And all the while that's going on, he's going to be missing such fundamental issues that, again, as I say, would be available to him or her. I guess Patricia Churchland, I mustn't leave out of this, or anyone like that. Just from an ordinary phenomenology of consciousness in every moment of life, however ordinary the acts of consciousness seem. That remains fascinating to me because if you can get someone to see that there's a fundamental irreducibility of of the structure of consciousness to mechanistic materialism, then the rest becomes plausible, follows, it opens the mind. But if you can't get this through, then no amount of merely quantitative evidence of other people's experiences that you present them with will convince them of a damn thing.
Kind of agree with you. I do think there's a path in there that I feel comfortable with, and that is the science, if you will, of near-death experience. And it is a science. We have 100 or 200 peer-reviewed papers on that. And we have the science of after-death communication all over the place. But I think if we focus on that as a falsification of materialism, I think what it really brings forward is the metaphysics of materialism, right? Because if it's argued correctly, it says, okay, what's really at stake here, guys, we're calling into question, if you will, materialism. And in the process, let's re-examine what they're really trying to sell you here, folks. Because you are not a biological robot in a meaningless universe, and you never thought you were, but you kind of went along with it. So I think when your confidence in materialism wanes a little bit, I think that's an opening for what you're talking about.
No, you may be right. But again, I mean, let me put it this way. There's a certain sort of psychology involved here that can erect defenses against that. But let's...
Pathology, I think you call it, quite correctly.
Sure. But yeah, so yeah, if you can amass, if you can accumulate sufficient evidence, that should call into question these easy materialist assumptions, yeah, sure, that has a clarifying effect. Still, again, my interests are in the whole, how can I put it, set of logical assumptions underlying naturalism that don't accord with any experience at all, not just extraordinary experiences, but any experience at all. So the person reading it may never have heard of an NDE, may never have had an intuition of something happening at a distance or something, dreamt something before it happened. I mean, these are all common experiences, and they're attested to, but they're attested to from a first-person stance. But if the person who has no experience of this, sitting alone in a room reading an argument, can from that examine his or her own states of consciousness and recognize the problem, then it's much harder simply to ignore what becomes, you know, insistently obvious day to day. That is my interest. I mean, it is, you know, I am interested in a philosophical account of the structure of consciousness and the way that it not only leaves us without a naturalist account of the self, but inexorably moves towards statements about the transcendent reality of consciousness.
What's the best way for people to follow what you're doing?
Well, Christmas is coming up. I got lots of books out there on the market. I don't know. I a person who prefers to publish. And for health reasons of late anyway, I don't do as much public speaking, but I keep up a fairly continuous flow of publication.
I say that, and we will have links, folks, in the show notes. You do write frequently, both articles and in the longer form of books. There's lots of videos that people can find on YouTube. So you are out there. And
I have to admit, I'm not very media savvy, so I don't really know what things are on YouTube or not. But I'm told by my students that it's an easy thing to find.
Oh yeah, you're out there.
and I don't do, you know, blogging or anything of that sort. I really find computers kind of depressing and the cyber world kind of dull, and I'm just a few years too old to have the right kind of enthusiasm for it. So I'm afraid publication rather than daily articles.
Well, I'll tell you what, it's been absolutely great talking to you and digging into your work. I'm super excited to hear about your book on consciousness and the further exploration of the philosophical underpinnings of it. So we'll keep an eye out for that. And if you're up for it, would love to have you back on to talk about that when it's out.
Okay, that sounds good to me.
Thanks again to Dr. David Bentley Hart for joining me today on Skeptico. I'd tee up one question from this interview. Extraordinary or ordinary? Dr. Hart says that he's explicitly drawn his attention away from extraordinary human consciousness. NDEs, medium communication, out-of-body travel, whatever, wherever you want to go with that. He said, instead, we should look at our ordinary experiences with everyday consciousness and the extraordinariness of that ordinary consciousness. It's an interesting idea, especially given the topics we cover here on Skeptico. So I'd like to hear what you think about that. Extraordinary or ordinary? Of course, the place to let me know what you're thinking is through the Skeptico website at skeptiko.com. From there, you can bounce on over to the forum and join us in the dialogue there, or send me an email, send me a Facebook, however you want to connect with me, I'll try and respond. Of course, while you're at the website, you can check out all the previous almost 300 shows of Skeptico. You can download them, subscribe to them. I hope you do all that stuff. You can subscribe to the newsletter where we'll keep you up to date on when a new episode comes out. So that might be something you want to check out as well. I do have some great shows coming up. Many of them have been suggested to me by you. And by the way, if you have a suggestion for a guest, email me, let me know. I can't guarantee that we'll always do the show you suggest. And you might have to sell me a little bit on that along the way, but that's a fun part of the process as well.
The main thing is to stay in touch, stay connected, take this little Skeptico experiment where you want it to go by getting involved. Or don't get involved and just stick around, because we do have some good shows coming up, as I just mentioned. Well, that's going to do it for this Christmas episode of Skeptico. It is just a few days before Christmas as I record this, so Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays, all that stuff. The main thing is enjoy the break, and until next time, take care and bye for now.